Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast that looks at different areas of film, arts and media and their significance in culture. I'm your host, Paula Blair, and in this episode, I'd like to take stock and chat to you about where we're at with the show and some of the things I've been working on so far in 2022, because I've been doing quite a lot of writing and not so much recording. But before I get stuck in, I want to give my deepest thanks to our incredible patrons at patreon.com/AVCultures. If you're not already one of our patrons and you're interested in accessing exclusive bonus content, such as the unedited video recordings of interviews of me doing these introductions and things, outtake reels or other kinds of extras that I put out just for patrons at different tiers, do go and check out the tiers and see what's on offer. Even if you join at the pay what you can tier, you can join from £1 or $1 a month, for example. And you can be on that tier, you can be on any tier and pay more than the asking price for that tier. I think that's just a minimum and you can choose to put it up if you really want to. But even just at the lowest tier, you'll get early access to these episodes. You know, you'll get them a few days before everybody else can listen, either on Patreon directly or through your own dedicated RSS feed for patrons already who should have access to those. If you're not accessing those and you're having problems with that, just let me know, because I don't know if there's a problem if somebody doesn't tell me. So the link for our Patreon is also in the show notes, but it's dead quick. If you just do patreon.com/AVCultures, you'll find us. And also if you look at our website at audiovisualcultures.com, it's all one word, all lowercase, you'll be able to find all of those links as well as the full show notes, transcript, and lots more information. And you can also donate directly in various ways on the website. You know, if you use PayPal, if you've got money in your PayPal and it's weighing heavily in your PayPal account, I will happily take some of it off your hands for you. Those are nice ways to support, and thank you for anything you do already. But a massive thanks as well to those of you who engage on social media. Our Instagram is ticking up. I think just right at the end of March, we hit 400 followers. That was quite exciting. That's the most followers the podcast has had on any social media. I gave up really with the Facebook for a while. I mostly use the Facebook to, you know, use the Meta thing because it's connected to Instagram as well. So I use it to schedule posts and stories and stuff, which doesn't always work, which is annoying, but you know, it's a free service. So the Facebook, and I think really just the day before I'm recording this, the Facebook page, I don't know, it started telling me to update it or something, and I was clicking all the no buttons and it did that thing where a no button suddenly became a yes without me realizing, and it updated the page and I had more followers than there were likes. And now all of those are gone. I don't know. I don't understand. Instagram is fun. Twitter was the one I got good at, and then it became a trash fire. But say hello on Twitter as well, because I am really active for the podcast, at least on Twitter. But thanks for people who reach out on those. We have had some lovely comments. I'm starting to read out now at the start of every episode. I'm reading out, and we've had some really nice feedback from somebody who's been listening. I've started putting these on as testimonials on our webpage as well. So if you go to the homepage of our website, if you keep scrolling down to the bottom, you'll see the most recent testimonials posted there. And I'm working my way through giving somebody a shout out for that because I really appreciate it. It just means a lot that people are listening, and it's lovely to hear that. Because I suppose I wanted to build a community with this, but you know, I'm an introvert and all sorts of other things, you know, and probably a bit of a misanthrope as well. So I'm not very good at being central to a community. but I'd like to have community. It's a weird one, I know. Anyway, so I had some really lovely comments from Dr. Fiona Noble, who guested on the show in episode 104. Please have a listen to that if you've missed it or you've joined us since then or, you know, it fell off your radar. It's a really lovely conversation. Fiona and I are good friends, so there is a bit of banter and that sort of stuff as well. I'm very cheeky with her. I'm more cheeky with her than I am with a lot of other guests because usually guests are strangers or people I've never met before, whereas Fiona and I have known each other a good number of years now and I can be cheeky with her, be myself with her. When I say cheeky, I mean be myself. So that episode is about her research on contemporary Spanish cinema and language teaching. On the 28th of January this year, Fiona kindly tweeted, and I quote, "My brilliant friend at P. Blair creates the podcast Audiovisual Cultures at AV Cultures Pod. This week's episode is an absolute treat. Super important conversation with Damien Taylor about privilege and the patriarchy, among lots of other interesting topics. Highly recommend. 2!" Thank you, Fiona. This kind of feedback really G's me on. And I've, as I say, started linking these comments on our website, audiovisualcultures.com. So if you'd also like a shout out in the show or on the homepage, let people know that you're listening. Let me know that you're listening. You can email audiovisualcultures@gmail.com or, you know, get in touch in any of these ways. Just love to hear from you. Love to hear about what's working and what you want to hear more of. Really interested in constructive feedback because I want this show to be useful. It's not just me making friends on the internet, which it sometimes has felt like for the past couple of years. This is not a bad thing for an introvert. It's the best, one of the best places to make nice friends is the internet, but it's also quite a scary place. Because I know you're dying for an update, the last time I checked, the United States ousted Belgium for the top spot in our listener league table. I know. Whomever shall be next. So just hello to our American friends. I'm so glad that you're listening. It's great to have you as well. Right, so in other feedback I had recently, the listener explained that they find themselves listening to the guest, and that's all grand, but then something the guest has said calls something to mind for me and I start talking about it. But because I tend not to want to take up too much space and I worry that I'm talking too much, and you don't need me to tell you, I go off on tangents. Because I'm trying to avoid all of that, I tend to speed through what I'm saying, you know, the anecdote that I'm saying, because it's usually off the cuff, it's unplanned in the discussion. And I just want to get back to the guests as soon as possible and hopefully bounce off each other as a conversation. But the listener told me it seems that I have interesting stuff to say and they wanted to hear more of that. So boys a dear, are you getting that today? You're going to get so much you'll ask me never to do it again. This made me take a bit of pause because AVC wasn't always primarily an interview show. A lot of you may have just joined in the past couple of years. You may not have bothered going back through the archive of episodes. You know, this is episode 117, so there's been a lot over the past few years. So making this mostly pivoted to being an interview show as more of a default during the pandemic. Before then, I was interviewing people in person, but I made a lot of episodes with Dr. Andrew Scheel, who was more of a co-host for the first 2 years, because even when we did interview people, we would do it together. Once the lockdowns began in March 2020, certainly here in the UK, Andrew's workload as a senior lecturer at a university completely exploded. I suppose just a note to any of you who might assume that your university staff had an easy ride of things when working from home had to happen. I can tell you as a witness that his already far too heavy workload more than doubled, and with no support, only pressure from his employer. And at the time when they first went into lockdown, there were strike actions happening. So these people already had a lack of goodwill left, but because of this global catastrophe that was unfolding, people, for the most part, I think, really knuckled down and did what they could for their students and just tried to keep themselves afloat. As I was planning notes for this recording, beginning back in March of 2022, so 2 years later, there is ongoing strike action from the University and Colleges Union in the United Kingdom. And just this one issue is way down the list of harmful practices that the union's fighting against. So I'm not going to go into details of that because it's not my fight, but it's a fight that I support and I have solidarity for. I didn't survive that system. I am a casualty of that system, and I have the utmost empathy and sympathy for anyone who's in the fray and is going through it at the moment. I'm just sort of laying out some information and just fleshing out a bit more context about, I suppose, the shape of the show, because this is really what we're talking about. That's just a bit of a spike off the narrative. But back to this notion of taking up space, and I'm sure it was in an episode of Ai Wei with Jameela Jamil, which is a podcast I really love. I can't recall which episode or who it was she was talking to, but she and her guest were talking about taking up the space, which is quite a feminist action. And it's action I've been hearing about for years as well on the Guilty Feminist podcast. But this time it was pointed out that to take up space is to make space. And by default, that's what making a podcast does. Do you know, it just comes to my mind, it might not even have been Ai Wei, it might have been on a podcast called Toxic Leadership, where somebody said this. It was one of those two. They're both excellent podcasts that I highly recommend. They're great, you know, if you're struggling with your mental health in any way or any of that. They're very pro dealing with that sort of stuff and having no shame about it, you know, so I really recommend them. But anyway, it was one of those where somebody put it like this, and I'd never really heard that before, where to take up space means you're making space, and that space you're taking up, you can share with people. And I think that by default, that's what making a podcast does. You make space for yourself, you know, you take up some space out there and you make space. And, you know, especially when you invite other people on it. And I think people have said this to me before, and I don't think I took enough notice of it. But when you have guests on your podcast, it means that you share that space that you've taken. You know, and I think in more recently, in the past couple of years, and giving more of that space over to other people, I have probably forgotten a bit about myself, and I've hidden behind that quite a lot, you know, where I'm going, look at this great person, they have loads of stuff to say, and I'm never going, look at me, I'm a great person and I have stuff to say. It's very narcissistic, but in a way it's true. You know, I got stuff to say. I've got ideas in my brain. I started the podcast because I had compiled loads of academic work and research on these areas of arts and culture and things like that, and have a lot to say about them. But also because my interests are much more wide ranging than just the specific research interests I had as an academic, and I wanted to explore those and start to demonstrate how, you know, the things that we do to letterbox things and categorize them and institutionalize them isn't always helpful. And it's probably not a bad idea to be looser about things, be open-minded, you know, and to recognize that there are slippages and that borders don't have to be fixed. They can be perforated. They can blend and meld and slip and slide and all those sorts of analogies. All of this is related to a more general time of introspection for me. I feel that I've come a long way mentally in the past few months and years. and I've regained focus and determination. I'm feeling clearer on what I want to do with my life, and I've been taking action towards trying to make that happen. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly when this began, because all our lives we're in a state of becoming. But I'd say that it's rooted in a decision I made in summer 2021, so nearly a year ago from recording this. And that was to take a break from my volunteer work with an incredible charity here in the northeast of England called Action Language, whose mission is to supply free English lessons to displaced people seeking asylum and who have refugee status in the UK. I had been a volunteer teaching and administrative assistant with them for 3.5 years at that point. It's interesting because even since writing these notes, I'm mithering about, which is a great North English word, mithering. I learned that one in Lancaster. I've been mithering about whether to join this charity's Action Foundation, their parent charity's team for the Great North Run this year. It's in September. It's apparently the world's biggest half marathon. I mean, it's the same size as any other half marathon because it's a half marathon, but it's a big deal. Andrew, my partner, who is often on the show, he is a massive fan. He's run it twice now. He ran it last year. He loves a half marathon. He really does. He got on in the ballot for this year, and a good friend of mine who told me she really wanted to do it again, and she really wanted to work on her fitness and use it as an excuse to work on her fitness again. I told her about the charity places that Action Foundation still has, and she got in touch with them straight away. And I'm still undecided. I mean, I think it's something I really want to do, but it's more the money up front is something I'm quite anxious about, and then probably resourcing up. But anyway, I've gone on a massive tangent there. It's a charity that's very much in my heart. I'm recording this as well when the war that Russia has started in Ukraine is raging and things are terrible. I think it's brought broader awareness of what's going on with displaced people, people who are displaced by violence and war in their home country. And this is something I've cared about for a really long time. I will point out that I am frustrated that there are a lot of people who only seem to care now that it's happening to white people and our European neighbours. But this has been actively happening for a really long time in a lot of other places. And our countries have a lot to do with that. You know, in Middle Eastern countries, in North African countries, in some South American countries as well. You know, the Global South. Oh, the Global North has a lot to answer for. But now that something, there's a crisis in the Global North and it's people who look more like me, that's now an issue. You know, that's something that's bothering me a lot. And so, you know, it's on my mind that I want to help this charity still in some way that has been doing really incredible work for years with people from all over. Now, I always felt that with the language assistance, you know, and the just a few hours a week I used to do, and throughout the lockdowns, we were doing lessons over Zoom and it was tiring and I was quite dependable. And I think I felt really guilty because although I'm not, my freelance work really seriously dried up over the whole lockdown and it has not recovered. I'm still in a really privileged position compared to so many people. So I think I felt a lot of guilt about that for a long time. And I think I was volunteering for a long time because I felt guilty. And I wasn't really taking enough time to address my own health problems. You know, when I was assisting with language classes, you know, I really enjoyed the administrative stuff because I used to help people enroll. And it was fun because there were times when I would get to use a bit of my Spanish. I have a little bit of Spanish. I'm about 5 in Spanish. But things like, you know, the registration form where it's just stuff like your age, where you went to school, fill in your name, stuff like that. Those are the sorts of basic things I can say and or say enough that it can be communicable. You know, I always felt that that wasn't much of a contribution in the grand scheme of things. It's not. It's piddling. Upholding human rights and attaining social justice are major concerns for me. And I feel rather helpless in doing anything about any of those things just about all of the time. I mean, the thing I do the most is I have my MP tortured, my Member of Parliament. I have her absolutely tortured. I'm never done writing to her about stuff. And that's where my skills lie. I am not skilled at going and doing demonstrations in a city centre. I just have so much social anxiety and sensory overstimulation that I can't really cope with those sorts of situations, even when they're very, very mild. But my goodness, I can write a letter. So that's just where my skills lie. And, you know, the revolution needs people of all kinds. I think if you're doing something, that's the thing, isn't it? I always felt that if loads of us did a little bit of the thing that we're good at, then everything would improve. You know, just from everybody taking a tiny bit of effort, then it would improve for most people. And I realised then that the wee tiny bit I was doing was a lot more than many others do, maybe in their whole lives. And that doesn't mean anything special, and I'm absolutely not passing judgment on anyone. I'm just telling a blunt truth. You know, I'm not somebody who has oodles of money. I don't have expendable income, so it's difficult for me to just give money to a charity at the moment. But when I had free time, I mucked in and I did something. And it was something I felt able to do in time I felt able to give. And there are a lot of people who have more time than that and don't give it, or they have better social skills than I do and don't use them. And so what? That's not a judgment. I'm not saying you should be ashamed. Absolutely not. No, it's about choice. And I think being brutally honest, was I doing what I did because I felt guilty, because I felt shame at being a working class person who was no longer able to work and find themselves unable to work in structured environments? You know, I think I pulled back a bit because I had to address that stuff, and that is what I've been doing a lot of in the past few months. You know, so I'm not passing judgment on any of us at all. Nobody should be carrying any shame about that, because life is difficult and we never know what is going to be thrown at us next. I mean, I get a bit frustrated when I hear or I read people saying, oh, I wish I could do something, but you know, they never actively find something that they could do, or maybe they'll offer a prayer. And the only acceptable response to that is, and I quote from Sister Michael in Derry Girls, sure, what good would that do? Even if it feels minuscule, there is something that each of us can do. And I feel like it's quite a socialist idea that if we all pitch in a tiny bit, then it'll be dead easy, because all the work will get done. I think that's probably the disparity, isn't it? Is when we've got so many billionaires and multimillionaires in the world who have all the money and the rest of us have so little of the rest of the money. It's a tricky one, isn't it? You know, I mean, if they give a lot, that's still small change for them, you know, so I recognise that. I hope you know what I mean, and that the very least, you know, it's coming from a good place. It's coming from a caring place, even if I'm fudging how I'm saying it. What became difficult for me about following through on this decisive action, you know, and I think it was decisive action, and I'll explain why I took it shortly, you know, in a bit more detail. But last August when the Taliban took control of Afghanistan. And I mean, how do we even perceive that? Did they take control? Did the United States hand it back to them? I don't know where the line is there, but there were all those extra people who were fleeing for their safety. And, you know, it was really tough to stand by the decision I had already made at that point, because the language lessons, they're not just about learning English. It's about community. It's about getting to grips with different accents. And I'm quite useful for that, having a different accent in a place where actually, I mean, to be honest, some of my nice memories of my volunteer work are a lot of the students responding to me well, because they could understand me better than they could understand locals, and that's people with a Geordie accent. I get looked at like I'm an alien over here all the time because people don't understand what I'm saying. And I try and enunciate properly the way I'm doing here. I try and separate every word and I speak slowly. When I'm in Belfast, I'll speed up and I'll talk a bit more like this. But when I'm, you know, in England, which is where I am all the time at the minute, I do tend to speak slowly because, you know, even English people don't always understand. That's people with the same language. So imagine what it's like for people who are thrown into a country, well, who have maybe had to fight to get into a country where they'd be a bit safer than other countries where they're supposed to be safe. And they don't know the language. You know, it's terrifying. It's so scary. I mean, it's stressful enough having a different accent, but speaking the language, you know, it's so unimaginably tough. And for a lot of people, it was just finding out, the classes were about finding out how things work culturally, socially and practically, and seeing friendly faces and making new friends and having a reprieve from trauma and being able to laugh and smile and find joy and comfort for maybe it might have been only those couple of hours a week in the class. I'm serious, you know, people were having tough, tough times. You know, I met people who had been trafficked. I met people who traversed deserts and seas to get there. You know, young men for whom it was kill or be killed. People have gone through awful, awful things. And then to be able to turn up to a class and to feel pride in yourself when you've worked really hard and you've done well and you're missing your family desperately and you're maybe stuck in a shabby hotel room and you're not allowed to work and you get these few pounds a week that you have to live off for a whole week and everything's really expensive and you don't know how to ask for the food that you might need. Everything's unfamiliar to you. I mean, it's so scary, you know. So I felt a lot of guilt around this for quite a while, which isn't healthy. I mean, what I decided to do was I felt like I was at a crux with my mental well-being. You know, I feel like I've done really well and a lot of the pandemic was probably strangely good for me because it meant that I could face down a lot of stuff that was dragging on and on and on, you know, and I was getting intrusive thoughts and intrusive memories. You know, I was diagnosed with PTSD and I had some treatment for that, which I had to get through a charity and I did it online. It was typing. It was all through instant messaging rather than speaking, which was actually quite interesting for me because I found that because I'm a better writer than I am a speaker, maybe you notice the difference between when I'm riffing like I am right now and when I'm reading notes. You know, if I go off piste, it's going to be a bit more all over the place and pausing and things. Anyway, so I felt really fortunate to have had that opportunity and I took an opportunity and grasped it with both hands because I'm so determined to be well and to make a proper living and I really need to sort myself out. You know, I'm in my late 30s. I'm too young to wallow. I'm too young to just waste away, you know, and I love doing this podcast. If I could make a job out of doing this sort of work, I would. But at the moment, it's from the kindness of a few friends that I get anything from it at all. You know, that's quite tough actually when you work really hard on it and, you know, it's your baby and you nurture it and do everything for it. I work so hard in it and not really, people aren't necessary. People are taking notice. And I mean, it's hard to feel worse in that when you're not really competing with, but you're on platforms that are dominated by people who have millions of downloads, you know, and I'm not hyperbolizing there. I'm being serious when I say that, you know, there are celebrity podcasts that have millions of downloads. There's no way I can ever dream to attain that. I barely have 100 downloads in every episode the week it comes out. But honestly, every individual listen, I appreciate. I appreciate you. I appreciate you hearing this and sticking with me. It's really important to get that perspective that the quality really matters. You know, so I'm trying my best with it, but I just can't make a living off it at all. At all. So, you know, I need to be realistic about that. And in my heart of hearts, I'm a writer. And so that's what I've been focusing on for the past while. And I think I moved away from doing my volunteering because I just needed to get my health really finally over that finish line and complete that really hard work of getting well, well enough to work, you know, in a structured workplace again, as well as I think to really make a concerted effort at applying for jobs. But I think I'm being more specific in where I'm applying to. So we'll get on to that sort of thing now. Yeah, so I've been applying fairly solidly for things for a few months now, but of course keeping the podcast going too. So you might be aware, if you're a regular listener, you might be aware that in January, I had an absolute just flood of recordings. I did loads of recordings. I participated in the Slacks Radio Residency at New Bridge Project here in Newcastle. And I made 3 recordings for that. And everybody involved was really kind enough to let me use the full recordings of those for podcast episodes, you know, and one of them in particular was, you know, more than twice as long as I could actually fit into the residency slots. So that was really great to have those episodes coming out of that too. So that meant, you know, 3 episodes, which is 6 weeks for me because it's every other Wednesday, you know, so I had everything scheduled right up to the end of April. But that meant in January, I got really quite burnt out. I think it was just a lot of talking to strangers, you know, it was a lot of hustling and it was a lot of very quickly getting up to speed with people I'd never spoken to before or, you know, hadn't spoken to for a long time or I knew who they were and they didn't know me. I think the first recording I did do for it was actually with a good friend, with Dick, who you might know now. That definitely helped. But all the other recordings I did were with people who I either had never spoken to before we actually recorded or who I knew and they probably would vaguely recognize me, but not necessarily. So anyway, so after such a busy January, I struggled to know what to do with myself in February. I just knew that I was burnt out and I had a bit of grace from the podcast. I turned matchmaker.fm off. As I say, I've been actively applying for jobs and not actually getting anywhere. And I find it tough with little money coming in to know what to focus on next because I've got so many projects that are partially done. They're at various stages. I just couldn't decide, right, what should I jump into again? What should I fire up? What should I try to complete? I just find this really difficult to decide because, you know, I had all these questions such as, well, what has the best chance of being published? And if it gets published, will it sell? Or what can I focus on the best? What am I going to maintain interest in? What might actually produce some income? You know, if I manage to write a book, can I get it with a more popular press? And then I'll actually get some royalties for something I've published. Quite a lot of last year, not just with charities, but I was volunteering my time to quite a few different things. And I have been doing that for years. And I think I'd got to a point as well where I've just become really weary of working for free. I'm tired of it. I am worth a lot. I have a lot to give. And I'm a really hard, conscientious worker. Never mind all the expertise and experience I can bring to something. And I'm so tired of working for free. I am not independently wealthy in any way. I have been freeloading off my partner for 5 years. All of these anxieties came to a head for me in late January, early February this year. And I resolved to really figure all of this out. And I perked up a bit when I reached out to my very dear friend, Joanna Leach, who spoke to me for episode 71 about the Amabe project. Please do check this out if you haven't already. It's a really lovely episode, again, a bit like Fiona. Jo is my longest serving friend. We've known each other for 20 years, 25 years. Oh my God, I just realised how old I am. We've got a really good rapport, probably too good, because, you know, we might verge into, you know, speaking in ways that no one else will understand because, you know, teenage girls. But yeah, check that out. It's a really lovely episode. Yeah, we had a catch up when I was on my own for a few days. You know, it was a really fun catch up. And Jo told me about an exhibition she was pulling together about neon at Havelock House. Now, I'm not going to go through explaining what all of this is because I've put some links in the show notes where you can find out more about Joanna and Bending Glass, her exhibition. You know, that'll explain, if you're interested, that'll explain what Havelock House is and why this is a big deal. As we talked, I became increasingly fascinated by everything she was telling me, in particular, the history of neon. I'd never really thought about neon before, and it's honestly, it's so fascinating, and I really want to share what, you know, the research that I've done on this now. That, as well as the old Ulster television studios and archives. You know, we were talking about this, and I was getting really, really interested and having ideas about it. And so Jo asked me if I'd be interested in writing something. And I agreed to this before I was even offered a fee because it was just so interesting, which is probably partly why I don't get paid enough for stuff. Because I'm just like, yeah, sounds great, let's do it. Yeah, but I just had to know more about this. I just caught the bug. You know, I was a bit inspired by another thing I'd caught a bug for, and that has not gone away at all. I was really inspired by the guide text written by Amy Corey for Damien Hirst's major exhibition, Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable. And I suggested writing a small exhibition guide that would tour through the Bending Glass show and the works and engage a bit with the works, not explain them, but just engage with them, you know, be adjacent to them, you know, while also giving just some information that might be useful, might be enlightening, might be interesting. And it was intended to accompany rather than prescribe, right, this is what this means and this is how you should feel about this and in this room you should feel this. And no, I'm not interested in that kind of art writing. I wanted to be adjacent with it. And Jo very kindly said that she considered me to be one of the artists and that this was one of the pieces of work in the exhibition, you know, and I was really excited about that. I so enjoyed the process of researching and writing this. It just fired me up completely and it gave me that excitement for engaging with art, technology and craft that the Treasures exhibition had done nearly 5 years ago. So as that came to a head, more opportunities to apply for came up. I feel like we're not done with neon at the time of recording this. There's actually still quite a bit to do because, you know, the thing that I was commissioned to do, it's all done. But, you know, I was also writing an essay about that and then that got abandoned because all this other stuff kept coming up. And I haven't as yet managed to get back to it because these other things became urgent, whereas the neon is now an interest that I want to do something with, you know, so it's that tricky thing, that freelancer thing of, well, I've been offered money to do this or there's that job to apply for and they have to take priority just because I ain't got no money coming in. So I had some rejections that I actually felt fine about because they ruled things out. And I started to feel more like that about things I was applying for. You know, there were a few things I applied for and I knew I didn't meet the criteria and certainly not in the way that the organization was intending. So I knew I was a wild card. You know, it was just one of those where I just thought, you know what? Just have to try because if you're not in it, you can't win it. It was one of those where you 100% won't get this if you don't apply for it. And it could be life-changing if you do get it. So there's no reason not to try. So I've been working under that attitude for quite a while. I was getting rejections for these that were not a surprise. And some of them were written very nicely. And that actually always helps when you, an HR person, is an actual human and not just an automated message that's saying, yeah, you didn't get the job, can't give you feedback, bye. When it's an actual human saying, really appreciate you taking the time to research and you write so passionately about your interest in this job, you know, we can't short you list you this time, but, you know, we hope you'll apply for stuff again. You know, that kind of thing is just really meaningful, to acknowledge that somebody took time out of their life to really research and be considered in why they'd be a great employee for you. You know, and I think that needs to happen more. And I'm really done with all these places that just go, oh, well, we had, you know, so many applicants. Well, what does that mean? Did you have 50 or did you have 250? Because what's too many? Where's that line where you're not going to give somebody feedback? You know, you're not going to let me know that I've been knocked out of the running by an algorithm and not a human. It's a bugbear. A lot of my anxiety then in February was really in deciding again what to do next, and knowing that certain things couldn't happen actually helped clear the fog. It was like, well, I tried. Okay, so I'm done. I did the best I could do there. It's a no-go. So that's actually ruled something out. That's good. I can try and focus. You know, it's pulled something out, so I can now narrow the focus onto something that might work. And spurred on by these few rejections, I thrashed out an application to Arts Council England's Developing Your Creative Practice grant, about which I'm waiting to hear. Even when this episode releases, I still won't have heard yet. So, you know, it's a 10-week process. To be honest, I just feel really pleased with myself for just getting it in, because just doing one of these applications, just getting it through the Grantium submission system, it's nothing short of combative. So anyone who just gets through that system and gets through the eligibility checks, you're a hero, because it's tough. It's really tough. They don't make it easy for people. Even when you're as prepared as you can possibly be, it's a really painful, very long process. You know, there's a lot of job applications I put in for, and it's, you maybe spend ages thrashing out your documents and stuff, but then the actual submission is just upload that, fill that in, boom, 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 20 minutes, grand, cup of tea. Whereas this was a whole morning. You were starting quite early in the morning, you know, and finishing quite late on. The day before, because, you know, the cutoff was at noon, and I just thought, what if? So I did it the day before. It's not an easy process to do. So I just thought, well, that's an achievement in itself. Just having made an ACE application is something to be proud of this year. You know, because I found this out to my detriment when I tried to design a proposal for a project grant, and that's a much bigger grant, and it's a much more unwieldy beast. I was aiming to submit that early in 2021, and the process of it just utterly broke me. I thought I was really prepared. I'd been to webinars, I'd read all the guidance, I'd done all the stuff. But, you know, as much as I did prepare for it, I was not prepared for it. You may as well have flung me against a wall, honestly. But I was mentally prepared for it this time. I knew what to expect, and it's a much smaller grant. It's a much smaller form, still a massive, confusing form, and it's not user-friendly, but I had a better idea of what to expect, and I was able to work it out, and I didn't panic. You know, it's definitely better to try the smaller fund, and it's a fund that's just about me developing how I work, rather than, you know, something I'm not necessarily in the right headspace for, because I think I had a really solid project idea, but I don't think I was in the right headspace to manage such a thing, you know, and be the producer of it. So preparing my creative practice application also then fed into another opportunity that came up, and it meant that I had a clear project in mind to propose. You know, it's all building into something. So even if I'm hoping, even if all of that work comes to more rejection, I think I've got a much more solid idea of where to go on a specific project that might have some traction if I can just find the right people to approach about it for various reasons. In addition to all of that, I unexpectedly got an occasional gig as a judge for a writing competition. You know, it's one of those things where every now and again, because I, you know, I'm on LinkedIn and I have some job notifications, because sometimes you get some things that are, you know, quick apply, and it's good to be visible on a on that professional social media, I guess. And, you know, I'll get some notifications and then I'll go for the thing, really not expecting to get anything out of it, because maybe they're not being serious, or maybe they're paying peanuts. There are loads of things like that, small things where I've applied for them and I just never hear from them again. Or I do hear from them and it's only in the United States or something like that. Or you have to be able to travel or something for your buttons that they're going to pay you. So anyway, so I put in for this judging thing. You know, I went to their website and I applied, I checked it all out, and just never expected to hear from them again. You know, I just told them about myself and that was it. And yeah, they offered me some judging on a short story competition and I really, really enjoyed it. I was sad when I finished my, I finished my batch and then I got another batch, really enjoyed it, and then got a third batch. And oh my goodness, the stories were so strong. I enjoyed it so much. People are just so creative and brave for putting themselves out there like that. And I learned quite a lot as well, because it's something I've grappled with for quite a long time, is how to deliver feedback in ways that don't just emotionally destroy people. You know, I've had a lot of time as a both as a recipient and as a giver of academic feedback. You know, and I think in the creative space, it's different because things are much more subjective. I think with this, it was just more about, you know, you're not evaluating it in the sense of how many marks does this deserve sense. I mean, in a way you are because you're judging it, but it's not in that sense of this is how you've proven that you can meet the criteria. It's not about that. It's how good a story can you tell? How good is your characterization? You know, and it's more where your feedback can say things like, I got really lost in these characters. I wanted to spend more time with them. Or that twist at the end hit me like a sucker punch. That is brilliant. You know, stuff like that. And even when something's not been particularly well written, but you can think, well, I can see the story you were trying to tell and your descriptions were really vivid. And maybe if you tried this, it might facilitate that a bit better. You know, it was just lovely to be able to write feedback that might actually help people, you know, improve their writing and their storytelling. You know, I hope that's what I was doing. So, you know, I find that the place I've arrived at, I think mentally, from 5 years of really tough learning and work at recovery from a catastrophic breakdown, total burnout, and also reflecting on experiences with editors in the past who've at best introduced errors into my work, and unfortunately this is something that happens an awful lot, or at worst they've actually trashed it on a really personal level and they haven't fed back objectively, or, you know, without bias, or in a way that's appropriate to the intention of the piece, you know, appropriate to the enterprise of what's going on, or it's just maybe factually incorrect. You know, I've had a range of those experiences as well. And I just really relished that opportunity, you know, because the competition really demanded this. You know, I think going through all their training stuff, they were very clear that, you know, you had to approach reading these knowing that everyone tried their best with the absolute best of intentions and they loved telling that story, and you had to meet them on those terms. You had to meet them in that place of, I just need to get this out of my body. I have these ideas and I just need to tell this tale. And they're learning their craft, you know, because some of them can be quite young people and some of them are writing in a language that isn't their first language, and some people are picking up a hobby they've never been interested in or had time to be interested in literature ever before, and maybe they're in their retirement and they're trying it out as a hobby. You know, there's all different things, and I think there's quite serious writers who might use the competition as a way of trying out something for publication. You know, there's a really wide range of entrants to this competition. So my role became, how do you help them improve? Again, it's very subjective because different judges will read it and read the same story in a different way and come away with different things. You know, I was sort of coming at it from, well, this is my knowledge of this genre. This is my knowledge of telling a short story. This is my knowledge of characterization and fiction. This is my knowledge of language. You know, and my role, I felt, was to point out where things weren't quite working and where things really were working. And maybe to offer, like, I think if it had some of this, maybe that would help. You know, it was just really, really enjoyable. And I hope it's been useful to other people. I mean, as indicated earlier, you know, I often think back to when I was teaching, and I really do agonize over whether or not I was mean to my students when marking their work and in class and all sorts of things. And I certainly have made howling mistakes there. You know, when you have a memory of something and it stings you. Thank gosh, that was stupid. And I think I'm trying to just lean into that a bit and think, you know, I just need to sit with the embarrassment of that, because I don't know how that affected the person who was on the receiving end of the mistake that I'd made. You know, because I remember a student referring to a certain film, and the film was a different spelling of the word, and I don't know, a brain fart, I don't know, just was getting it, no, you're spelling this wrong, you're continually spelling this wrong. And didn't, you know, now I would check, you know, now I would doubt myself and I would go, I'll just have a wee check on their internet in case I'm going mad. And then I would say, oh, it is called that. Ah, interesting. Okay, that's me. I've learned something today. But previous overworked, strung out, stressed to the max me didn't do that. And that student was probably very rightly felt a sense of injustice with that. That stays with me. And I beat myself up too much about that sort of thing. But I learn from that. You know, I take that on board and I use that sting of embarrassment and shame to learn and not do that, hopefully, to someone ever again. Or at least double check myself. Because I'm not always to be trusted. I forget things. So when things are anonymized and online, it is really easy to dissociate from the person, the human being who's at the other end of that. Maybe this has come up with judges before where they've had that, because there's lots of messages in your feedback form about, you do not insult people, because they've clearly had that happen quite a lot. And the stories are all anonymized. We don't know who has written them or where they're from, or, you know, maybe there's very clear indications that English isn't their first language, but you cannot take that for granted, because there might be people with dyslexia or learning disabilities or not very high literacy who might be writing in. And apparently that's happened before, where it is a native English speaker and they've been really, really insulted by a judge calling them out for their poor grasp of the English language. You know, so it's something you actually have to be careful about when everything's anonymized. I think that's absolutely right. You know, and I think certainly in this scenario, you know, it's really stopped me in my tracks and made me think about that sort of thing, you know, because it's really not on to make somebody feel bad when, especially when they've put their heart and soul into something with really good, pure intention. And what has struck me is I've been reading work the authors really wanted to write. And that is a major shift from years of reading student essays where, and I am grossly generalizing here because I had so many where this was not the case, but a lot of the time, and I think increasingly over the years, it came across that students resent having to do assignments. I mean, it feels as if, you know, certainly hearing about Andrew's more recent experiences as well, it feels as if things have really changed since I was an undergrad. But then there are people I talk to who were an undergrad before even I was. And for them, they thought this sort of thing was always the case. So I don't know, but I feel like introducing really astronomical tuition fees has been a massive part in this sense of entitlement that comes with a resentment of having to do any work. You know, so that's not all students, but it's enough of them that it makes the job of teaching them really miserable sometimes. So again, that's all part of a totally separate issue. Actually, this whole podcast is lots of separate issues that I'm just rambling on about. So whether anyone makes it through this or not, I don't know. I'm not going to, you know, go into detail on that again. I'm really happy to talk out some of these issues and debate some of these things with people, you know, and I'm very happy to stand corrected. I'm always willing to stand corrected. And I'm always happy to put caveats in because I know it's not always the case. And I think emotionally, it was so draining to work in that kind of environment where you're really undervalued, really underappreciated, and people are treating you as if you're a teacher and they haven't got a choice to be at university. And you think, well, a bunch of years ago, you didn't have a choice to be at school and your teacher didn't have a choice and you didn't have a choice about your teacher. That is not how it works in tertiary education. You came here. What I will suggest, you know, in case anyone listening is on either side of this student teaching staff dichotomy, is that you're all being pitted against each other, you know, and I can say this quite safely from observing it from outside now. You're all being pitted against each other as a distraction from management malpractices. And you can overcome that triangulation, you know, which is a term you should look up, to do with abusive behaviours. And you can overcome that by being each other's allies. I'm just going to float that. Listen to each other, make friends, students, the people lecturing you and leading your seminars. And your seminars are not lectures. They're not your enemy and they are not the man. So just lay off a bit. And I suppose for teaching staff, these young people have so much against them right now. It's not even funny. I'm a geriatric millennial and I'm finding life really tough. I just feel like 2008 economic crash just took so much away from people like me. And I was one of the lucky ones who scraped through into 2008 with something. A lot of ones who, you know, were a bit younger than me didn't have that. It's a tough road, you know, and these younger ones, it's not fun out there, guys. You know, we need to help each other. From I was young, I was an avid reader and I developed a love of writing. These strengthened as I aged. I'm quite an internal person, you know, something I've always been aware of about myself. I've got such a vivid imagination and I daydream a lot. I reverie a lot. You know, I write stuff. I mean, you're hearing me rambling on about stuff. Now I am essentially talking to myself, but doing it to a microphone. And then someday somebody else might hear some of it so that I'm no longer just talking to myself. Make content out of talking to yourself. Why not? These loves of reading and writing, they meant that as I aged, I didn't know how, but just some way, somehow, I just wanted to be a writer for a long time. And I see now, with the wrong intentions, I wanted to be a great academic. And that includes writing. You know, it was a way that I could write loads of stuff and be published and have my name on things. And I certainly had potential to be a great academic, and I was a very good one. But so much of the profession makes me miserable. It is not a world that is built for me. It is a world that attacks me and damages me. I do. I feel like I'm hurled against walls repeatedly. It's like Spider-Man being thrown into brick walls constantly. That's sort of what it feels like. Only I don't bounce back with an exoskeleton. It does damage every time. My brain doesn't fit into those systems. And the worst of that was in the last job I was in at University of Salford. It just was the most combative to my brain and how my brain and my body work. And the damage I'm talking about in my case was literal. I lost a lot of my cognitive abilities when I became ill with stress 5 years ago. You know, it's been 5 years and I've been reflecting on this quite a bit. And, you know, I've had the good fortune as well as the determination in these past few years to really get to know myself and to study what's going on with me, because it's been a bit difficult to access a lot of medical help. You know, I was struggling to really get help. You know, I think it's a really awful irony that you actually have to be well enough to seek help, because I couldn't physically say the words for such a long time that I needed help. And then by the time I could, a pandemic had broken out and it wasn't physically safe to go and see the doctor, and I wasn't urgent enough. They had to deal with people with really urgent physiological illnesses. So mental health always takes a back seat. That does affect you physically, but not as much as, you know, a raging cancer or diabetes or something like that. So you take a back seat. I learned my slower operating system. I learned about things that helped me rebuild. I gained insight. I worked towards assessments that might help diagnose what's going on with me. Not that I think they're illnesses, but they're conditions that I live with and that I operate under and within. And, you know, it's really powerful actually to learn from other people's experiences. So I appreciate that a lot. And I think that inspires me to do things like this where I ramble at you, but hopefully, you know, maybe there's somebody who's hearing this who won't expect to hear something like this in an arts and culture podcast, you know, because it is all related, I suppose, in a very roundabout way. What I'm getting at is it is the love and the passion and my specialist interests in everything that this podcast is about that has kept me going, that has saved my life, that has given me reason to keep going and to be, you know, to help me learn about myself and to help me learn about others and what they're going through, and to develop even stronger empathy. And I have too much capacity for empathy already, so I didn't really, you know, need that. But it is a way of working through, I think, a lot of emotions and thinking about information and getting stopped in your tracks and being asked awkward questions or something confronting you with something you hadn't thought about before. Seeing a craft that somebody's worked really hard to develop and you can appreciate that. You know, I mean, all of that, it just fires me up and does wonders for my mental health. And that's why, you know, we need to take arts and culture seriously, because that can actually address the shortfall that's in our underfunded National Health Service here. It can help us help ourselves, and it has definitely helped me to see myself and to figure myself out and to take that time to learn how to properly administer self-care, you know, in a medical sense, not in a have a wee blush bath and get covered in glitter and feel pampered. I mean, do the hard work of getting therapy, of being able to say what's going on in your harmed brain. You know, it's really tough. How good I am at any of the writing, I don't think it's for me to say. I get some really great feedback. I get some very helpful, constructive feedback. I've had some really rubbish feedback that just goes, I don't like that. Change that to something I like that I'll be happy with, even though I'm not the audience, which is something I've had before from an editor. You know, but I know that I'm a creative person with an intuitive brain, and I think I've been railing against that for too long. And I love logic, don't get me wrong. And I am a logical person. I solve puzzles. I love, you know, problem solving and logical argumentation. But I am also really intuitive about me. When I make things, I'll measure it quite vaguely and go, yeah, it looks right. Or I'll, when cooking, I'll go, I wonder what that'll taste like. And it goes, you know, so I'll try stuff and I'll be intuitive and I'll go, well, that worked with that. So these flavors are quite good together. So maybe that'll do something. Let's just say, shut the door and run away. You know, so I have those things and I have a real passion for learning. I have a low capacity for short-term memory. And I think something I've learned really very, very, very recently is that it's more likely that I have a slow processing time, which is why I struggle to hold things in my head. And I struggle to hold more than one thing in my head at a time, because I get frustrated with myself with language learning, just as an example, where you're doing listening exercises, you know, and I'm well into intermediate stage with my Irish and Spanish, and I'm having to replay the audio over and over and over because I can only keep about four words in my head at once. I can't do the whole sentence in one go. I remember that being an issue when I was doing GCSE French as well. I just really struggled to remember. You know, it's not that I struggle to know how to answer necessarily. It's more, I can't remember half the things you just said to me because I have to hold all this in my head because you're trying to And I mean, the way you learn languages later in life, when you've sort of lost that natural capacity from childhood, you tend to go through acts of translation. And I try really hard to associate, especially with nouns, it's easier with things, but associate the thing with its word. Or este is just another word for orange, and orange is just another word for naranja, for example. Anyway, another tangent, but you know, it's made me realize, like, when the more I'm learning about female autism, you know, and ADHD, is that actually, you know, I have quick bursts of memory. I just can't hold loads of it all at the one time, and it's slow to process. So it is going in. It just takes more time than it does for most people to percolate for me. So, you know, if we have a conversation about something, I'll probably immediately forget what we've just talked about. But in about 10 years' time, I'll tell you nearly word for word what you said to me. Because I've found that ability really strange, that I can remember stuff that happened years ago really well, like really acutely, too acutely, too well, like intrusively well. But I can't remember what somebody said to me this morning or yesterday. It just takes a while to process for me. So it's a really important thing to learn, I think. And that's why it's good for me to have an archive, and I write stuff down all the time. And I think you need to learn to work at whatever pace you're in and not be too anxious about that. You know, I think I spent a lot of time being frustrated that my brain's just not working the way it used to. Part of it's age and part of it is a complete burnout. That does damage. You know, and I think that's one of the issues with not recognizing mental health issues. And I mean, when I say mental health, I mean neurological well-being as well as, you know, the depression, anxiety side of things as well. It does damage. Connections get broken. Things get harmed. You know, there are physical repercussions to burnouts, and it takes quite a while to heal from those, just as it would with any other kind of injury, you know. So psychiatric injury is just not something we know enough about or take seriously. You know, so for me, I know, as I say, I need to take one thing at a time and focus on it and allow myself to become absorbed. You know, I have an ability to hyper focus. I love writing. When I handwrite, it just flows for me. I mean, I'm still just reading from handwritten notes that I wrote a while ago. As Pragya Argaval says quite a lot, if you do any sort of writing, you're a writer, and I'm a writer. That's whether I'm a good writer is for other people to decide, but it's something I need to do, and it's something I want to do. I am motivated to do it, and I have to overcome, I suppose, the quite Methodist nobility and suffering and hard work that is quite hardwired in me. It isn't a frivolous thing to do if it gives me release and contentment, and it helps me keep my mood even and gives me an outlet for things. I think that can only ever be a good thing, and not doing it, getting out of practice with that, is not helpful. I suppose to come back to it, the stories that people write and send to competitions, that's them training and practicing spinning a good yarn. And there's no more joyous thing to me than a good story told well. You know, we evolved, humans evolved to be communicative beings. All of our primate cousins are communicative in some way. And look at us, look what we have developed, the languages and all the different kinds of communicating that we've developed. And we found ways of telling our stories, primarily to ourselves, and then sharing them with others and making them up for others. And our capacity to produce and to send and receive stories makes us human. It's what we are. There's nothing frivolous about our very existence. I've had to really face myself down with that, because I struggled to write a lot during the pandemic, and I kept on my weekly blog for as long as I could, and I did a lot of very personal stuff on there. People were very kind and said they appreciated how honest I was about things. That really meant a lot. There are times when I've let that go, and it's usually at times when my depressions are really quite bad. You know, I've been trying more to make an effort to make sure I have something on the blog, even if it's just something I've dug out of my archive of files, just to have something out there to make sure that I'm reading what I've written and doing something with it. You know, it's all part of momentum and practice and evaluation, because a lot of it isn't very good. So you have to look at it and go, well, this can be better, and here's the ways that it could improve, and that's good. So I've been feeling very introspective about all of this. I haven't had much to give out lately, really, in general. But if anybody hears this and any of it strikes a chord, I hope you find your way. And I know you can find your way if you take the time to spend with yourself. That's really hard to do. Some of us hadn't had a choice in the past couple of years. We were faced with ourselves, and that was terrifying. But if you're able to do it on your own terms, and you can make that time for yourself non-negotiable, I really hope and I believe that you can figure out whatever it is you're mithering about too, if you are. And if you're not, and if you're all sorted, I'm so happy for you, honestly. I'm always ever trying to find my way with stuff. You know, with the job and the grant applications I've been writing recently, I feel as if I'm inclining towards that. I've been trying to read more as well. You know, I'm trying to find, I suppose, a path back to my younger self. I used to devour books, and I think doing an English degree has really, really spoilt me for books. I just lost the love of reading, but adult pressures and having to read stuff for work takes the fun out of it a bit, you know, so it can take me a while to really get into reading again anyway. So I have been trying to read more lately, and I read a lot of nonfiction these days, actually, and I really enjoy it when I do read fiction. I think I just have so many books that I've owned for ages and have maybe only read them partially because it was for teaching or research, or I picked it up and I never had time to just actually sit and read it or whatever it was. You know, I've just got too many books that I own and I have not read. So I'm just trying to work through what I've got. You know, it's interesting what catches my attention and what I get bored with and wander off in my mind from as I'm reading internally. You know, I have to just be honest about that. I'm too old to suffer through things anymore. I've realized this about myself, and this is an ADHD thing, that I have very little to no attention for anything that I find really dry or I can't visualize when I'm reading. You know, if I can't imagine it in my head, I get really, really bored. You know, if I don't really understand the words that are being said, or if things are described in a really bland way, I'm not with you. So, and sometimes, you know, I have good ideas while I'm bored reading somebody else's writing. And I think that's quite rude, but there's also no point in not being honest. I'm not going to say who I'm doing that with. That's not really fair, because I'm sure other people get loads out of their really excellent writing. It's just I personally find it boring. I mean, I'm also trying to read the books I've already got, because my income and bank balance plummeted throughout 2021, and they haven't recovered. I mean, I just totted up my earnings for 2021-22 financial year, and it's actually slightly less than the year before, which is really depressing. Grateful for anything that I got, but didn't get enough. HMRC messed me about big time last summer. Still really upset about that, because I was entitled to a payment from them that I didn't get, and that's annoying. But you know, I resorted to trading and selling a lot of my stuff, including a lot of my books. You know, it was pretty heartbreaking to trade in a book that I'd bought for 18 quid 10 years ago for 50p, but I needed the 50p and the space on my shelf more than I needed the book anymore. So I just had to, you know, I just figure that if I ever want them badly enough, then I can pick them up again. Maybe I'll have more money in the future somehow. If any of these jobs or funding applications ever work out, maybe I'll be solvent again. But you know, the money, as I say, it was just more useful than having the object collecting dust in somebody else's house. You know, so I'm trying to read what I'm willing to part with, and then hopefully have more space and money for the things I do struggle to put down and devour the way I used to. So I usually have two books on the go. The one on my bedside table, it's usually the more enjoyable one. And then I have another one beside the sofa, so that there's no excuse, no downtime. Andrew pauses things and runs off quite a lot when we're watching something, and it's infuriating. So I always have something to do for a minute while I'm just sitting there and he's faffing about. Always have a strategy, no downtime. Can't just be idle. The book beside the sofa at the time of doing this, it's quite a dry scholarly text that's actually a bunch of separate essays by the author published over a number of years that have been pulled together as one book about a specific topic. And that's all perfectly fine. And it's a really important contribution to the specific field. But I'm really bored with it and it's just not going in. I'm not caring about any of it. There's lots of claims about generalized viewers and I find that really grating after a while because I think we can really only speak for ourselves. Unless we have data from new surveys or, you know, monitored audience participation, I just don't think it's useful to go, and the viewer feels this, well, do they? You know, I get really tired of reading this in film studies or art books and stuff. And I go, well, I saw that and I did not feel like that. Do not speak for me. I think because there's nice photos in it of stuff, the descriptions are a bit wishy-washy and very technical. And you're like, what was it like to move through the space, you know, describe, paint it for me in your words, and it's quite boring when that doesn't happen for me. But you know, it's a useful exercise in discovering what I no longer want to read, because it's also no longer what I want to write. I don't want to write like that. A nice compliment that I get when I do art writing is that people can visualize what I'm talking about. You know, even if it's not an accurate visualization, they can see something and they can feel something because of the way I've written about it. And that's really meaningful to me that people take the time to tell me that. Somebody once told me, you know, I read what you said and it made me want to be there and I don't like going to galleries. I mean, that's really high praise. That's what you want. I've always wanted my research to be as accessible as possible. I know it hasn't always been. A lot of my PhD was very heavy theory and philosophy. I don't think I can even really delve into a lot of that anymore. When my brain worked better, I could work with those complex theories and philosophies, you know, to do with time and memory, the very ontology of film and photography and all of that. You know, I'm still interested in that to an extent, but I think a lot of the very dry language that can be associated with that, I don't care anymore. And, you know, I think I've really lost the ability to do the really, really complex stuff. I mean, the stuff that's just combative, frankly. And then you get a lot of it lost in translation. You mean, translators do amazing work, but my God, the French stuff can be so dense sometimes. Anyway, I don't have the desire really to build up to that again because I'm quite frankly bored with, and I do want to be frank about this. You know, the old white European dudes who've been telling us how it is when it's not that way for most people's lived experience. Just, you know, to really put that out there. I've moved on because I have these bits of embossed paper that show that at one time I had a proven ability to do all of that. I proved that I could do that, that I could work with Deleuze and Foucault and Baudrillard and all them fellas. And I just want another challenge, you know, and that challenge for me is, well, how do I make these complex ideas accessible to people who think that none of that nonsense is for them? Because I grew up not realizing that art galleries were for me. I don't want anyone ever to grow up feeling that, because they're for everybody. Of course they are. Shouldn't even be an issue. You know, what I'm interested in then is developing my own creative, critical nonfiction writing that is upfront about my lived experience, as well as the knowledge and research that I've acquired over these years. And this is something I fill about with on my blog if you ever read it. I've linked it in the show notes if you want to stop by and have a browse. And I'd like to step this up and take it further. You know, I'd like to write a book that people might pick up in Waterstones or reputable bookshops that pay their taxes. You know, there's a few more books in me. I've written one already and I've contributed to others. I have these other ones. I have these really vivid, strong ideas for other ones and I want to get them out. You know, I'm telling you all of this because I started to feel burnt out with the podcast there in January. Gosh, that was a long time getting to that from when I mentioned this. You know, 4 years I've been doing the podcast now, and in that time I've learned tremendous amounts and met loads of fantastic people and collaborators. I'm keeping it going. This isn't a goodbye. We've already had Wittertainment wrap up. We don't need me joining that bandwagon. No, I'm not going anywhere. I mean, they're not going anywhere. They're just going somewhere else. I think the podcast, I think in just terms of my work, it's going to take a bit more of a backseat. I'm going to do more things like this, not just talking at you about stuff, but when I have other episodes later where it's just me talking, it'll be about something, I swear, you know, but I'm just having a break from the hustle, because having had a break since January, because I had a big hustle all through the autumn, and then January, quite another big one. And it's actually been really lovely to not do that for a few months. And I realized that I was actually getting quite frazzled and close to burnout. You know, when I try to force myself to get back into that fray again of emailing this person, that person, that person, arranging time zones and chatting with strangers and trying to be super clear in my communications, I just get stuck because I can't be bothered. Like, it's just draining of my creative energy. And rather than just fighting it and doing it anyway, for work I'm not getting paid for, because whatever patronage I get for this, I don't take the money. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the podcast, and I use it for the podcast, you know, and you can go and visit and have a look around the website to see what I mean by that. I don't take a wage for doing this, and it's too small an amount of money to pay me a wage anyway. So I've been just pondering about, well, why is that? Why do I get stuck when I have to do that hustle? I think it's because that while it is fun and it often produces really great results that I don't regret at all, you know, I do find it draining even when it's really enjoyable. I just find it completely drains me. It takes all that creative energy away from other pursuits. I'm too tired to write. I can't think straight. And to be blunt, I am just weary of working for free. You know, so as grateful as I am for the patronage, what I get in a month is a tiny bit more than an hour's worth of a real living wage in the UK. I'm a volunteer for my company, Cozy Pea Pod. I don't earn enough from that company to pay myself any fees. So it gets the money. I have spreadsheets where I track all of this because, you know, I need money for things. You know, so I know what belongs where, what's for what. And, you know, ABC has its own spreadsheet. I keep track of what money belongs to it. And so this is where I've been able to look and see, okay, I have enough to replace my laptop battery that's just started to fail, or upgrade the website, for example. And one-off payments, if anybody is interested, I do record those on there as well. They all add up to that. You know, I have to keep afloat now to maintain the website for its annual payment, bits and pieces like that. You know, it accumulates the things that I need for the show, you know, equipment I can upgrade, that sort of thing. I have some goals on my Patreon site. So, you know, you can go and look those up and see what I'm working towards. If you want to drop a few quid via the Acast supporter link, do look at the show notes. They'll be in there. And if you can leave a tip to help out, that would be great. It all adds up and it all helps. I just need to be where I am with all of this, and I make use of content that I've already in some way produced, or see what comes along without much effort on my part. You know, because there are times when I've said to people, I'd love you on the podcast. Oh yeah, I'd love to do it. And then we just don't arrange anything. Yes, I need to put effort in, but I also need to know that you want to do it, because I can't pay anyone. So, you know, if you really want to do it, then just reach out. You know, it's fine, but I'm not necessarily going to chase people. And I'm at the minute just not going to be very good about chasing people for content, because I've got some. So, you know, again, just being blunt, and probably people like me talking like that, but, you know, that's just how it is. It's a lot doing everything for a podcast by yourself. I think people maybe assume that, like a lot of other podcasters, I just send this off and it magically gets done. I do everything for this beast. I do everything. This is my entire baby. I do all the things, every bit of it. You know, so unless I'm talking to somebody else and then they're giving me that content, that's great. But other than that, I'm doing everything: graphic design, editing, marketing, and the social media, which I'm scaling back on. I really just need to scale that back while I regain some energy and try other ways of making a living, because this has not made me a living. This has made me a tiny bit of pocket money that's not even mine. You know, and preferably, I'd like to make a living with my first love of writing. And an example is, you know, I had ideas for two episodes where I was intending to focus on the Array Collective's win of the Turner Prize back in December. You know, they're a collective that actually I've known for a long time. I visited the show and, you know, I invited them on the show back in 2019 when I was visiting Belfast. Again, I invited them last August when they were nominated for the Turner Prize. I don't know if they got the messages or if they're too busy or it all went straight into their junk mail, or if, you know, there's just 11 of them and you may as well try and herd cats. I didn't hear anything back and I didn't chase them because other people wanted to be on the show. I don't have an employee who's chasing that stuff up. It's me. I have to do it. And I find that really exhausting. If loads of people approach me and want to guest, that's easy for me because then I have to do the hard work of getting them booked on and scheduling things. And a lot of these people are in the United States, so we're working with the time difference. Again, I'm so grateful, but it's still hard work for me. I just never chased any of it up. You know, with the Array stuff, I mean, everybody's very welcome anytime on this show. It's just, this is about me just not having the energy or the wherewithal to chase people. And then I thought with Array as well, you know, they're just doing loads of podcasts and including the very marvelous Talk Art. You know, you should listen to them on that. And there are other ones they've been on as well. You know, I just don't know if there's anything more I can add because they've already had really interesting public discussions. I don't know if I have any questions or comments that will be in any way insightful because they've had really insightful public conversations. Their work raises issues with the state of arts criticism, as well as loads and loads and loads of other prescient issues. And, you know, this was written about superbly by Kira Hickey and Jane Morrow. Again, I will link that particular article in the show notes. I think that was with Elephant. I also floated with them doing an episode with them talking out what those problems are. And these are problems with art writing that a small organization like the White Pube, for example, is also trying to address in their way. You know, and I think some of my introspection recently has shown me that I want to confront this head on by finding or carving a way to get funded for critical writing that's also creative and accessible. And, you know, by critical, I mean engagement from a place of knowledge and learning, not criticizing, which is what reviewers seem to think very often that they're supposed to do, or that they enjoy doing, or whatever angle they're coming at this from. I'm not interested in punching down or defining what art can be and should be. Very much the opposite in my case. You know, I want to throw that debate wide open and challenge it and trouble it and dismantle imposed boundaries, which is what my scholarship has always been about. You know, it's been about that since I was, you know, a fully fledged youngling PhD. So I welcome and encourage anybody to join me in chatting about all of that and talking it all out. I want to listen and I want to learn. I want to ponder and I want to produce. I want to just soak it all up and then I'll have something to say. You know, when I have to do all the producing, the editing, the booking of people, that's the thing I find really tiring is just getting timings and stuff sorted out and booking people. And, you know, especially the marketing and, you know, for all of that stuff to happen, it renders me a lot less effective as a learner and a thinker. And so I'm trying to strike more of an efficient and effective balance in doing that work because I am not in a position to hire an assistant who's brilliant at doing all those things and loves doing all those things and finds all that dead easy. I'm as I am with this stuff. Now, I want you to tell me, and the email address is in the show notes. use that and write to me, you know, or go on the website and go to the contact page. How are you? How are you doing? What do you want to know? What do you want to hear about? Do you have any questions? Do you have any suggestions? Do you want to be a guest on the show for a conversation? Do you want to come on and tell me all about yourself and all the wonderful things that you do? Are you encountering frustrations or worries in your own creative life or career? I really want to know. I just don't want to have, you know, a 10-string email conversation about it. I just want to go, yeah, I want to be in your show. Here's the times I'm available. How about you? Yeah, can do that time. Here's a link. See you then. Check in. Good, we're all here. Let's go. That's kind of how I want to run it, because I haven't got the energy to go, I'm a bit busy that time. I can't really do that time in this time zone. And da 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 da. No, just tell me when you're available. Tell me when you want to come. Just assume that I am not busy. I am frighteningly available. I think before I leave you, I don't know, I'm going to float this. I'm going to attempt introducing a recommendations section. I mean, I've name dropped a bunch of stuff in this already, but if you want to subscribe to the newsletter, which you can do at audiovisualcultures.com, I have a Peas Pod Recs section where I recommend a podcast that I've been enjoying. And I'd love to start that here. You'd maybe talk about programs or films or books I've been watching or reading and getting a lot out of. You know, I'm very interested in you writing in to tell me what you're getting a lot out of and you'd like to share with people. You can email audiovisualcultures@gmail.com or join the mailing list and reply to a message. And if you do join that, you know, do make sure we're in your safe senders list, you know, and we're not going into your junk or spam, because that might be where a lot of messages are going from the initial people who signed up. If you'd like to view the full versions of lots of the Audiovisual Cultures recordings, this one's included. I've included a full video of this, which is going to be extremely long. We're at 2 hours, 11, 49, 50. That's how much I blather on, and there's extra stuff in there for behind the scenes tier people. So you can check that stuff out at patreon.com/AVCultures. You can have a look at all of the tiers. If you join in that tier, the behind the scenes tier, you can see all of my fumbling and all of the gaps and all of me knocking into the microphone and all sorts of endearing things that'll make you keep coming back for more and more and more adorable pea shenanigans. There might even be special messages just for you. There certainly is at the beginning of the video for this recording that's happening right now. If you got through all of this, thank you for sticking with me. The next episode, I promise, will be about something, definitely a thing, not just me rambling about things that come into my head. Mind yourselves. I would say catch you next time, but I've started listening to Maisie Hill's Period Power, and she says that at the end of every episode, so I'm going to change mine. I'm not going to be precious. I do not own those five words. So I'm going to change up my closing salutation, and I'm going to go back to an old favourite as ever. Be excellent to yourselves and each other, and party on, my dudes. Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/AVCultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license, and is available at ccmixer.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.